Can we indicate if you're hearing me okay? Okay, how's that? So I don't have a volume control here, so. All right, sounding better now? Okay, so thank you. I'm actually not in Ottawa at the moment. Those of you who follow me may know that my life has become topsy-turvy the last few weeks. So I'm actually calling you from a hotel room in Val-d'Or, Quebec, which is kind of strange, but I'm off on a bit of a northern road trip. Welcome from Val-d'Or, Quebec. It's the first time I've ever been here. I'm here to talk to you today about new trends in online learning. So I'm going to pop up some slides here. All right, there we go. I'm now sharing my screen. Am I sharing my whole screen? Oh, well, it doesn't matter, does it? So, slideshow from the beginning. There we go. So, although those are bulrushes from the Moncton area, so there's still some New Brunswick in this presentation. I want to begin with what I call the inflexible law of learning. And it's funny because every time I say this, people always say, well, everyone knows that. But it's funny because, you know, 80% of our effort seems to be dedicated to things that aren't this. So the inflexible law of learning is, it's when we do stuff that we learn, not when stuff does something for us. And I do a lot of work talking about and researching about the future of online learning and trends in online learning. And so many of the trends that I see have to do with stuff doing things for us. But really, in my mind, where we're going to go in the future is going to be toward stuff that helps us do stuff, because that's ultimately what will help us learn. So here's the first part of the presentation. I'm going to run through a number of things, six of them in fact, six basic areas that I think are fairly important trends that we ought to be aware of, and certainly, you know, have on our mind when we're thinking about planning for the future in this field. And they're very briefly machine learning, handheld computing and mobile computing, badges and blockchain, Internet of Things, games, sims, and VR, and translation and collaborative technology. All of these, or each of these, has seen fairly significant changes over the last 12 months that indicate to me anyways that these are the technologies that are going to form, you know, create the pieces of the puzzle. After I talk about these six things, I'm going to talk about the puzzle as a whole for a little while, because the future isn't just this technology and that technology. The future has a lot to do with how we see learning, how we practice learning, and where learning is going to go based on our needs and our expectations. So let me talk about machine learning and AI briefly. First of all, I want to point out that it's not simply for adaptive learning, and machine learning and AI will be used overall to create an environment. I gave a talk just the other day in Montreal called The Next Frontier, or sorry, The Final Frontier, Space. And if you go to my website and look that up, you'll see a comparison between the metaphor that we typically use for learning, which is one based in time, as compared to a metaphor that we will be using in the future one based on space. And the idea here is instead of a sequence of events, a sequence of activities, your typical learning design sort of scenario where you present this thing and then this thing and then this thing, the idea here would be to create an environment that has various affordances for people wishing to learn so that they can pick and choose the things that they want to do within that environment. So the example here you can see on the screen is a site that's actually been around for a while, and everybody ignores it when they talk about MOOCs and online learning. It's called Code Academy, and basically it's a coding environment, and on the left-hand side are instructions that help you code, but on the right-hand side is the actual code that you're working on at any given time, and then on the far right-hand side you can see the results of what you've done. So you have this interactive development environment in which you can learn and play with and practice with code. It's an open-ended kind of environment rather than a directed kind of environment, which is typical of online learning. So when we think of artificial intelligence, there are really three major kinds of artificial intelligence. Now, those of you who are experts in AI are going to say, no, there are many more types, etc., etc. So when I say there are three types of AI, what I'm doing is a very high-level, rough-and-ready characterization. But I do it so I can give you a sense of the different approaches that AI researchers take. One type of AI is called decision engines. They used to be called expert systems. They form the basis for a fair amount of artificial intelligence, but more importantly, I think they form the basis for a lot of people's popular conceptions of what artificial intelligence is. Think of like WebMD or something like that, where it asks questions and then there's this branching tree of responses. And as you go through each decision point, that narrows the range of possibilities. These are artificial intelligence systems that are based on a pre-established domain of knowledge, a semantics and an ontology, and then a set of rules that operate over that semantics and ontology. So think of it as rule-based artificial intelligence. The more prevalent forms of artificial intelligence are the next two. They're both based on neural networks or connectionist systems. A system like this is basically a mechanism which has an input layer of what they call units or nodes, where you can put data in and they're all connected to each other, and then there's an output layer which produces results. Now, I'm obviously glossing over a lot of the details. There are two major uses to which these kind of systems are put. And they're kind of related uses, but I think it's worth drawing out the distinctions between them. On the one hand, you have pattern recognition. And we've actually seen an example. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but if you look for it, there's a Google engine that has started merging images, or you give it an image and then it tries to detect patterns in this image, and it finds like frogs in a picture of a forest or things like that. The idea is that you give it partial data, disorganized data, chaotic data, and it recognizes patterns. So this works in a way similar to the way, for example, human vision works. When you look at something with your eyes, you get input onto your retina, and then the cells in your visual cortex pick out patterns in the environment through things like edge detection. The other major type of artificial intelligence is cluster detection. This is really useful for things like business intelligence, marketing, and classification, if you're doing automated sorting, automated classification, anything like that. And the idea is that you have a set of entities and you look at the properties of those entities and you organize them into groups. There's one algorithm, for example, it's fairly common called K-nearest neighbor, and it looks at the features of each entity and finds the nearest neighbor of each thing based on those features. So if you wanted, one example is automated grading, is a kind of cluster detection because you're looking at essays that are A, essays that are grade B, essays that are grade C. Well, how do you cluster those? Well, if you look at all of those essays and compare them with a base set of essays, previously marked essays, you can identify these clusters and automatically grade them. Again, very high level here. You can find some examples. I've put links at the bottom, and these slides will be available on my website after the talk if you want to look into that more. So, as a result of artificial intelligence and these kinds of systems, we have what are called learning analytics. The major dialogue today around learning analytics is mostly about data mining and predictive analytics. You look at Leap, for example, which was purchased by Desire to Learn. One of the things that they do is they say, looking at the pattern of behavior so far of a person in the course, what is the probability that they will finish the course? And the idea here is that if you predict a certain thing, like a low probability that they will finish, that triggers certain events, like a notification or a recommendation for a tutor or professor to intervene with that student, things like that. It's fairly useful, but useful, I think, in a fairly limited frame. I think learning analytics in the long run are going to be more in the realm of what is called today the quantified self. You've probably heard of the quantified self. An example of it is depicted on the right here. This is something called Runkeeper. I know I don't look like I run, and in fact I don't, but I do walk a lot and I do cycle a lot, and I use Runkeeper in order to keep track of my walks or my bicycle rides. And so it tracks where I've been, how long I've been. If I had a monitor, it could track my heart rate, and it also compares me with other people who are walking or cycling or whatever. And the idea here is that I have detailed activity information about myself. And then based on that information, I can do things like set goals, correct behaviors, understand my own patterns of behavior. So it's almost like it turns myself into the analytical engine. So basically, overall, in learning itself, we're going to have two major forms of learning analytics. As I mentioned, the predictive analytics that talk about how people are performing, how people will behave in a course, and then the recognition kind of tasks that will look at fairly narrow performance and identify trends. I'd be able to cluster things, apply the level of performance to rubrics, etc. Ultimately, the objective is what is called personalized learning. And I'm not a big fan of personalized learning, but this is no doubt a trend. Personalized learning looks at these properties, looks at comparisons between the given individual and other individuals in the class or in the course or through history, and builds on and employs rule-based events, user models, and adaptive learning in order to customize or adapt the learning platform to individual behavior. Now, I say I'm not a big fan of personalized learning. It's because a lot of this still falls under the heading of us doing things for you, right? And as I say off the top of this talk, learning is about people doing things for themselves. Second major trend. I'll go through this one rather more quickly because it's something that people are much more familiar with. You probably have an instance of it in your pocket, or I don't know if you have desks, but it doesn't look like, but if you had a desk, it would be on your desk. Handheld and mobile computing. Two major things to say here, just in terms of overall trends, and this is from Mary Meeker's report that just came out a few days ago. First of all, there has been a dramatic growth in the use of handheld and mobile computing. And you can see the tables there right in front of you. That's global smartphone unit shipments. I don't know, what is that? Turquoise? Turquoise is Android. Android has something like 80% of the market share. People don't realize that because everybody talks about Apple, but globally, when we look at it globally, Android has the vast bulk of the market for handheld and mobile computing. Apple has, most of the remaining 20%. The second thing to say about handheld and mobile computing is that the growth in this has slowed dramatically. Now, it's kind of hard to see from that chart, but the line on that chart is the year-over-year growth in percent, and the growth peaked in 2010 at about 80% year-over-year. So the market was increasing rapidly. But by 2015, it had dropped to about 10% growth year over year and will probably continue to drop. This indicates that the market for handheld and mobile computing has become stagnant. Well, not stagnant, but it's really slowed. It's saturated. Everybody's got a phone. So now the only people who are buying phones are people who need to replace their phones. So as a result of this, one thing is that I think the price of these things is going to come down considerably, which is good news for everybody. And secondly, the innovation in this field is going to take place not in new devices, but it's going to take place around the edges of what we can use these devices for. And I think that a big part of this is going to be in the area of performance support. The future of learning in mobile learning isn't the mobile phone itself. I know, a lot of people pretend like it is. They say, well, all these people who are in Africa using a mobile phone, that's great. But that's not the case. It's integrated performance support system. The phone is the thing that allows you to connect with things that are around you. So it's like you're carrying your own personal communication system with you. The pictured here on the right is a badminton racket, and you might think it was just a badminton racket, but your badminton racket connects with your phone via Bluetooth. There are sensors in the badminton racket and an application on your phone so that when you swing the badminton racket, the racket can rate your performance and send you back information. And then the racket and your phone work together, they're integrated, they work together to improve your performance swinging the badminton racket. We're going to see a lot more of this sort of thing where your phone works with devices around you to help you use those devices to do whatever it is that you want. This is a kind of learning that isn't based on a course or a program, but it's based on an environment and creating affordances or opportunities within that environment. Third major trend, Don Tapscott's been all over the media over the last, I guess now it's what, 2 or 3 weeks. He released a book. He's got a gazillion magazine articles. It's the idea of what's called blockchain. And this idea actually predates Don Tapscott, surprise, surprise. So here's the idea. You might be familiar with the concept of open badges, and I would put another slide there for open badges, but I didn't. But basically, the idea of an open badge is a credential that anybody can award for any achievement. And so if you think like Cub Scout badges or Boy Scout badges or even like medals or things like that, they're a very specific kind of recognition for achievements, and in our field, learning achievements. So there's a whole infrastructure that's been built by Mozilla around supporting and displaying badges, displaying them on your website, displaying them in third-party environments, etc. But the big problem with things like that is, how do you know they're true? If I can just display whatever badge I want, I'll give myself an MBA, a PhD, and a Nobel Prize because I can. So you need to, in some way, certify badges. So one way of doing it is with each badge, you have a link back to the original provider. Sounds like a great idea, but what if the provider goes out of business? What if the university closes? What if you move from one country to another country and there's a revolution in your first country? Yeah, things like that. So the blockchain is a way of recording the achievement in such a way that it can't be changed after the fact. So the blockchain itself is a technology that takes a record of the transaction, encrypts this record, and more to the point, encrypts this record in a chain with other records so that there's a single chain of records. So you can't change one of the records without changing all of the records. So the idea here is that once something is encrypted into the blockchain, it can't be changed. So if you record a badge or a certificate or something like that, and enter that into the blockchain, then you've created unchangeable evidence that the person has actually achieved that. And then you can put things in like specific mechanisms for verifying that the credential was awarded by such and such a university or such and such an agency. So there's a number of initiatives already taking place around the blockchain and testing and certification. This is from Audrey Waters, a couple of things. Sony has plans to launch a testing platform powered by blockchain, and IBM plans to offer blockchain as a service. The original blockchain was Bitcoin. After Bitcoin, a whole bunch of different digital currencies arose because anybody can create one, right? And then beyond that, now there are different technologies for producing blockchains. One of the more recent ones is called Ethereum. Ethereum is interesting because what it does is it allows any person to create any kind of certified statement. Money is just a certified statement. Degrees and diplomas are just certified statements. So you can do things like create contracts that are certified statements, agreements among people, records of achievement, anything like that. Ethereum's a decentralized platform, unlike, not quite the same as Bitcoin, and so isn't subject to some of the manipulations that Bitcoin is subject to. Based on Ethereum, just as an example of the sort of thing that you can do with this technology, something called the DAO has been created, and this launched maybe a month and a half ago. It's a quote unquote distributed corporation, and basically what it does is it receives investments from people, which of course are encoded in Ethereum, chooses projects and then pays for their development. So it contracts, it gets investments in, contracts with people. So the decisions are made by a distributed membership where everybody has a vote, and these votes can't be sold to third parties. So there's no possibility of a corporation taking over the DAO. So you have this distributed voting mechanism, this distributed funding mechanism, a lot like Kickstarter or things like that, and then this distributed workforce, a lot like Uber, for example, or Airbnb or Mechanical Turk, which pays for the projects. And so this is a leaderless, self-organizing mechanism for performing services and paying for those, you know, contracting and paying for services. It's called the DAO. So really interesting kind of thing. And it sort of makes me wonder, you know, like, imagine we set up education like that. What would that look like? And that's the sort of thing that keeps me up at night, wondering what that would look like, because it's so different from what we have now. Another thing, fourth major trend, Internet of Things. So the question here is, what happens when companies know the state of all your devices? I'm just quickly checking on time to make sure that I'm doing good, and I'm doing good. So Internet of Things, as you know, is your toaster has an internet address, and your toaster communicates with your fridge, and your fridge communicates with the grocery store, and you don't have to do anything because your toaster always has to. I'm exaggerating a bit. But the main thing is your devices become computers. One of the slides from Mary Meeker's presentation, that's the one I referred to earlier, has a picture, and the question is this a car or is this a computer? And of course, our car now is as much computer as it is car, at least my car is. It knows where you've been, it knows where you're going, it's smart enough to look backwards when you back up. There's all kinds of diagnostics in the engine that a mechanic can plug their computer into, or these days just use Bluetooth, etc. So we're in this position now. If you take the idea of mobile internet and devices that teach you, and now these devices are connected to the internet, so your tennis racket can learn from the internet about how all other people using that racket have used that racket, and then can convey that information to you. You, by contrast, have direct access to all those other people, and you can get their reviews, their ratings, etc., of this kind of racket. So on. Fifth trend, and it's a trend that has come and gone and come and gone more times than I can count. I'm really hesitant to add it, but there's been so much discussion around it, and especially in the area of simulations and virtual realities. So a couple of terminological points. Gamification is the adding of game elements to learning. Badges is actually a form of gamification, right? You learn things, you get points. You get enough points, you go up a level. There's argument and argumentation that I'm actually convinced by, that gamification is actually detrimental to learning. And that's something I want to think about more and look into more. But, it changes your motivation, and it changes the way you approach the subject so that you're more interested in earning the points as opposed to, say, obtaining the knowledge. There is some literature on that, and like I say, I want to look that up and think about that more. So I'm not convinced that gamification is an effective strategy. Serious games, by contrast, I don't like the phrase serious games because all games are serious and all games are playful. But serious games, or maybe learning games, are systems that employ a game to facilitate learning. A lot of the simulation kind of games are serious games. So, for example, one of the earliest serious game was a forest fire prevention game where you had a simulated environment, you have forest fires break out, you allocate resources to put out that fire, and then another fire breaks out, and then eventually your whole game is on fire if you don't manage your resources properly. That's a game that teaches you how to learn. There are various simulation engines that power those games. And I think that kind of game, especially as we add virtual reality to it, becomes a powerful immersive learning tool. This is the basis for things like flight simulators, in the military, combat simulators, nuclear reactor simulators, and any sort of control board that you're operating, driving simulators for driver training, etc. One of the major virtual reality engines or systems that has come out in recent years is something called Oculus Rift. Oculus Rift has an interesting history because it was started as a Kickstarter campaign. So you had one of these distributed funding models, but then it was acquired. So now Oculus Rift is owned by a company. I'm not stating the company because I've forgotten what it is just off the top of my head. But it's Amazon or Facebook or something like that. So the main point with Oculus Rift is that it's very immersive. It captures your total visual field, as you can see by the mask there, and the simulations are realistic enough and fast enough that they actually convince you that you're there. The list here is a list from Donald Clark about the different reactions that people have when they put on Oculus Rift and try it out, because he's been carrying a kit around and testing it with everybody that will let him test it on them. So you have the freezers who just freeze when they put it on, the smilers who just go with the flow, the grippers that grab onto the nearest person or thing and hold on for dear life, the swayers that sway with the scene, the screamers that not only sway but scream with the scene, and then the freakouts who are just overwhelmed by the whole experience. Kind of an interesting set of reactions. So imagine yourself learning how to perform skills. Now you've got your Internet of Things and your Oculus Rift, and so you have devices in your hand, maybe simulated welding, and you've got your Rift headset on, and so you're feeling the welding, you're seeing the welding, you're actually learning to weld, but you're not using any materials, and you're in your living room. This is the sort of scenario that's enabled by this kind of technology. Finally, the sixth trend, translation and collaborative technology. I've sort of mushed them together. It's an awkward fit, but it works. The artificial intelligence stuff that I talked about off the top of this presentation is rapidly, very rapidly leading us toward automated translation. I have an application on my phone that uses the camera. I can take it, I can point the camera to a sign. The sign can be in Turkish, and the application reads the sign and it recognizes it visually, reads it, and translates it for me. So I hold up the thing and I see the word, exit or stop or hospital or whatever. Real-time translation is coming. It'll probably be here within most of our lifetimes. I'm really looking forward to it. Although, I've already seen, and I'm sure you've already seen, you get translations of languages that are very different from our own, like Arabic, say, or Chinese, Mandarin, and you can translate the words, but the modes of expression are very different, and people relate to the world just in a completely different frame or a completely different perspective. And the interesting thing about automated translation now is it sort of hints at that perspective. The Arabic Facebook, for example, that I've seen, and I don't want to characterize this as everything, so much of the world is seen through the religious perspective. So every comment is God wills this, or hopefully God will allow that, etc. And it's kind of it's an interesting way of seeing the world. And it reminds me though of reading Descartes. And René Descartes, in his writing, begins the meditations with the prayer and then moves on. So it's the same, it's different, but other languages are not direct. Eastern Asian languages, for example, are not direct. There's a lot of use of metaphor and imagery, and these things don't translate. So you read things like, the black cat smiling at the moon. It's no idea what that means. I made that up, by the way. It's a totally made up example. The future, therefore, is going to be much more communicative. I think it's obvious even what we're doing here right now indicates that communication will be everywhere. And of course, the first thing that people say is collaboration will be everywhere. And there are a lot of collaborative tools out there, workflow engines, things like Slack, for example, which is a collaboration engine, content sharing, and development sites like GitHub. My take, though, is that the future will not be collaboration, the future will be cooperation. There's an important distinction between these two concepts. Collaboration involves working together for an agreed upon objective. And the real trick here is establishing an agreed upon objective. And usually that is the result or the creation of a hierarchical system or a system of payment or persuasion or in some cases coercion. There's always a management element to it. But I think we're going to see many more developments that are self-organizing and self-managing. And in the case of cooperation, there's still interaction, there's still sharing, but there's no expectation that you're all working toward the same objective. And there's no necessary expectation of a direct quid pro quo, or direct reciprocation. So cooperating, each of us still hangs on to what's important to us. Collaboration, everybody lines up under a single goal. I think cooperation, each of us pursuing, as John Stuart Mill says, our own good in our own way, is the wave of the future. A model like the Tao, which I discussed just a few moments ago, is an example of cooperation rather than collaboration. Each individual involved in the Tao is working on their own thing for their own purposes. Learning tools now will be based around this idea of cooperation, but it'll be a cooperation of learning technology. So a good example of this is what's called learning techno or learning tool interoperability, or LTI. It's a specification created by IMS Global, used to be called Instructional Management Services. And the idea is that you have this constellation of learning tools out there in the internet, and your tool, which might be, say, a learning management system, connects to these tools that are out there in the internet. So all of these tools are set up for their own purposes. They're managed according to their own way. What LTI does is provide the channel of communication between your tool and the other tool. And then you use that other tool however you want to use that other tool. So the vocabulary here is you have the tool provider who provides a tool or resource. And then you have the tool consumer, which is the system that is accessing that remote tool. So the typical example is for a learning management system to connect to, say, a simulation engine. So a person is taking their course in an LMS, they get to this point, they click on the button, the LMS connects to the simulation and up pops the simulation on their screen. But you know what, it doesn't have to be an LMS. We ran a project in Moncton not too long ago, in fact, just less than a year ago, where we had a MOOC, a Massive Open Online Course, and we used a personal learning environment. So that's a tool specifically for one individual. Think of it as like a web browser. And we accessed the MOOC using LTI from the personal learning environment. So I can use LTI to connect to a learning management system from a personal learning application in the same way I can use it inside a learning management system to connect to a third-party tool. And I think that what we're going to see is instead of people using these large centralized learning environments, people are going to be using a collection of tools that all seamlessly interoperate with each other using technology such as LTI. So you'll begin in your own personal space and you start doing whatever it is that you want to do, and you connect to this tool and then that tool and then that tool and then that tool. And it sounds chaotic, but that's exactly how the web works. You start with your home page in your browser, which is personal on your own computer, and then you go to this site and that site and that site and that site. And you do different things on those sites. You talk to your friends, you create documents, you upload pictures, you play games, you listen to music. All of these are provided by different tools, or we call them websites, that are connected to your personal tool through a certain set of standards or protocols. So the model exists, and this is a refinement, I would say, of that model. Making this work is cloud storage, but now we're looking not just at cloud storage of our data, as in Dropbox or Google Drive, but cloud storage of entire applications. For example, Moodle, which is a learning management system, can be stored in the cloud. My website, which has Grasshopper, which is a learning application, can be stored in the cloud. Most of the software that you use today is actually not hosted on the software site. It's hosted on a third-party site. So if, for example, you go to, I'll pick something out of the air and make something up. Go to Coursera. You go to the Coursera website, but the software that runs Coursera is actually sitting on Amazon Web Services. The Coursera website is simply a front end, and the software is distributed in the background. So take all of this now and apply a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about, badges and not so much blockchain yet. And now we're into a mechanism that can work toward and begin recording outcomes and competencies. This is a screenshot from Moodle 3.1. It's the most recent version of Moodle. There's a full competencies system and learning plan system built into Moodle now. And so the idea here is that you can identify the competencies that you would like to achieve, and then Moodle helps you, by connecting with all of these external resources, create a learning plan that supports your progression toward those competencies. And then ultimately, you'd receive a badge or recognition for having achieved that competency. And that badge or recognition would go in your personal learning record. So personal learning record, this is something that we worked on at NRC quite a bit. We continue to work on it. The idea of a personal learning record is that your learning record, everything to do with your achievements in education, or learning generally, are stored in a way that you have a complete record. It's not, you know, you have your St. Mary's University record and your St. John Ambulance record and your DeVry Institute of Technology record. All of your records are combined into a single personal learning record, which is about you. There's three major areas that I think will compose the personal learning record. On the one hand is an activity record. So what this is a list of, yeah, I guess list is a good word, of the activities that you've undertaken. There are systems out now called learning record stores, LRS, that store lists of your activities. They store this list in a format called XAPI, or the Experience API. And what the Experience API is, at its simplest, and I stress, I'm glossing over it a bit, is a list of what you've done in a subject, verb, object format. So, you know, John read War and Peace. Mary completed task 4, etc. So this is going to grow and change dramatically, but the XAPI specification already exists. It's in place. There's a number of learning record store providers out there now, and of course you can connect to these through programming interfaces with a learning management system or with a personal learning environment. As well, part of your personal learning record will be the things that you actually created. Your learning portfolio, your artifacts, the evidence, your badges, your blockchain, and ultimately that's the third part, the certificates, the credentials, the competencies that you've earned will be listed. So your PLR might enter these records in a blockchain, might enter these records in a third-party repository or information store. But ultimately, the idea is that if you have a PLR, you have a mechanism for providing your learning record, your record of accomplishments, first of all, to another, you know, to a learning system, a learning management system, a training provider, but secondly, to your employer, your potential employer, to a job-seeking site, or something like that. And here we get some of the matching algorithms and learning analytics that I've talked about. Look at your personal learning record, look at employment or job opportunities, present you with an offer that's suited to you. And then you enter into a contract, it's stored on the DAO and registered in a blockchain. That kind of picture is what we're moving toward. Supporting that is something called CAS, the Competency and Skills System Project. It's created by Advanced Distributed Learning. That's the organization created and contracted by the United States military. They are the people who created the SCORM, which is the shareable courseware object reference model. And that's the model that defines learning objects or basic units of learning. They're also involved in XAPI. And what CAS is basically a competency framework. So it defines all of the different competencies and a hierarchy of competencies in that domain. So, you know, it's military, so all the different competencies a midshipman might require. And then it creates a profile of a learner according to those competencies. And, it might say novice, intermediate, advanced, etc. And you get a personal profile of each person mapped against this competency framework. And that's what CAS is up to. Just for fun, I'll throw in a page about Docker. So the idea of Docker is to provide a back-end mechanism for all of this, and so to make a complex story simple, when I talked about putting applications onto the cloud, for example, the tools that run Coursera, storing them on Amazon Web Services, what Docker is a technology that enables you to do this. So you have an application, you put it in Docker, and basically what Docker is a completely everything you need in order to run that application. So you can create, it's like you can use Docker and create thousands of images of the same application and use an image for each different client that you have or each different person in your course. Everybody gets their own version of the application. So think about it now. Your application's in the cloud, your data's in the cloud, your learning record's in the cloud. All of this is distributed, and then at the front end, you have mechanisms that allow you to access this, manipulate this data, back up this data, secure this data. And these, again, are now all connected to your devices, to simulation systems, etc. So the concept of a single central learning management system, that's pretty much over. And we're entering a new generation of learning technologies. It's going to take some time to transition to that, but I can say that the major companies like Blackboard or Desire to Learn are well aware that this transition is taking place. And Desire to Learn, they don't even want to be called a learning management system anymore. They want to be called, I forget what it is, like digital learning platform or something like that. Okay, let's check time very quickly. Okay, not bad, not great, but okay. Let's talk a little bit. So that's the technological environment. Let's talk a bit, just to wrap up, about where this goes, what this means. How do we frame this? How do we think about this in our own mind? Because it's a mess, and it's a mess that's a bit hard to deal with. First of all, the promise of online learning is anytime, any place. But what that means is it's all about context. It's, like they say, context is the new content. Sometimes there's a place for a course, but most of the time, it's not the place for a course. The airplane cockpit, for example, is no place for a two-week course. If you're landing an airplane, what you need is the information you need precisely to accomplish that task in the right format, preferably in the right order, to land that plane, not a course. And that's going to be true generally. A lot of learning, as in learning for as preparation for a job, say, is going to be transformed into learning as support for a job or performance support, learning that helps you right now as you need help. I like to say, and I've said this for many years, learning in the future will be like water or electricity or like text. It'll be available when and where you need it. Right now, on the side of a fire extinguisher, you see instructions written in text. In the future, on the side of a fire extinguisher will be an RFID tag that your mobile phone picks up and connects to a full set of resources on the internet in the operations of that fire extinguisher. And it will also monitor the fire extinguisher, advise you when it needs to be replaced. And if you point the fire extinguisher toward the wrong kind of fire, your phone will beep and say, "Don't do that." Learning will be engaging But engaging means two things. It means immersive, it's environment specific, but it also means wanted. And this is one of the big things that the traditional learning environment has forgotten. They've forgotten the idea that learning has to be wanted in order to be engaging. What makes you do things in order to learn is that you want to do these things. Our physical actions, our mental actions, are the result of our volition. We desire to do something. We desire to accomplish something. So simply making something interactive, contra Terry Anderson, doesn't make it engaging. There is this aspect of we have to want to be there, and in the case of simulation, there has to be a suspension of belief. We have to actually believe that we're there. I read recently criticism of the use of virtual reality to teach people how to drive, because people when they're in the driving simulation, they know they're not gonna die, so they just crash into poles. They don't learn the reactions that they need to learn in order to preserve their own lives while they're driving. So you have to achieve this certain level of believability in a simulation in order to make it immersive. So they have to want to be there, they have to believe that they're there, and that is what creates the kind of activity that enables a person to learn. Learning is personal. I've been on about this recently, the last few years. I'm still on about this. I talked earlier about learning being personalized, and I talked about, adaptive learning systems and adaptive learning path creation, etc. I draw a distinction between personalized learning and personal learning, and it all goes back to this idea off the top of this presentation that you learn when you do stuff rather than when stuff is done for you. All of these adaptive learning systems that are really based about finding the right kind of content and presenting it to you, those are systems that do stuff for you. And those are not systems that create an ideal learning environment. An ideal learning environment is one where you begin by doing things and then you learn as a result of the error. Trial and error is the greatest teacher. Now, what's nice about our current interactive environment is that you're not alone anymore. You're not figuring it out for yourself. So you practice, you get a result, but then there's somebody there to help you, to support you as you go through each iteration. You still have to actually try. You still have to actually challenge yourself. You can't be spoon-fed the way a learning management system might do it. So there's a new model of learning, I think, that is emerging, a model based on self-agency, self-management, and action and practice and immersion in an immersive environment. This is the architecture that I think overall is going to support this personal learning architecture, this personal learning environment that will operate in the technological milieu that I've just described. Things like resource profiles for your data and for your personal learning record, resource aggregation for the stuff that's out there, the services, the tools that you use, the community that you connect to, the environment that you're immersed in, and even things like rights and sharing and contracts and all of the rest of it. So, from the perspective of the learning institution, which is probably the perspective that many of you are coming from, your role is shifting. Your role in the past has been the management of learning. But now your role in the future is going to be to offer perspective, to offer meaning, to offer purpose, guidance, and support. So, for example, One of the principles might be, don't do things to people, do things with people. Your purpose is not to evaluate people, your purpose is to help people. Alfie Kohn likes to say, if we have to ask, how do we motivate people, then we're taking the wrong approach. I've often said that motivation is required when you're trying to convince somebody to do something that they don't actually want to do. So if we have motivation issues, that's a sign to me that we're doing the wrong thing. What is your job? Your job now is knowledge sharing, not knowledge management, not learning management. And your job now is to provide opportunities and support. And as Pink says, opportunities for autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Your objective is to help them accomplish their objectives, not to get through the content. You see how it's a really different perspective from your traditional course. Learning outcomes. People talk about this a lot, especially in this self-managed, distributed kind of environment. I have a long story here, which I'll tell you very shortly or very briefly, and it's this. We're using an environment like the thing on the left there, an immersive environment, one with all kinds of tools and opportunities and affordances, and we're doing things. When we do things, that's when we learn, and what learning is precisely and exactly is the creation of a new set of connections or a modified set of connections in our neural network, in our brain. So basically, learning is a type of growth. We become or we develop into a person who has become a physicist or a carpenter or a plumber or a geographer or whatever. That's what we're doing. So the question of outcomes is, how do we know we've created one of these? How do we know we've created the right sort of growth in ourselves? Well, learning a discipline is, as they say, a total state. And this runs very much against the whole competency literature, but I think it's a total state. It's not a collection of a number of individual states. It's certainly not the acquisition of a number of facts. Being a physicist or being a carpenter is seeing the world like a physicist, seeing the world like a carpenter, asking certain kinds of questions, having certain expectations, a certain set of skills, things that you can do. A certain way of evaluating whether something is good or bad. It's actually achieved through immersion and practice in the domain, and it's expressed functionally. Can you perform as a geographer rather than cognitively? Can you list geography facts? So being educated in a discipline is ultimately expressed by your capacities, your skills, and your actual actions, your actual communications with other people, your expectations, etc. So, how do we know when we've reached that state? Well, we recognize it by what we actually do in the world. Now, you might think your first thought might be, well, that's behaviorism. Well, in a sense, it is. But in a sense, so is giving people a test, right? Ultimately, the only way the rest of the world gets to know what we know is if we show them. That's simply a logical truth. What's going to be different in the future is that we'll have many, many different ways of showing them. Not just a test, not just an exam or something like that, but all of the work that all we do that we do with all of these different tools, these simulation environments, these tennis rackets, the communications that we have with each other, the contracts that we enter into and deliver or not deliver, the questions that we ask, the questions that we answer, the sharing of knowledge that we do, all of these taken together are out there on the internet and can be accessed by the analytics and artificial intelligence tools that I talked to you about off the top of this presentation. We have the capacity, even with current technology, it just needs to be rolled out and implemented, to have a real-time evaluation of the capability level of each person in any given discipline. Real-time, right now, based on all of the data that you've provided to the internet. Now, there's all kinds of conditions that have to be in place before we actually use such a system. The sharing of data has to be voluntary. There has to be mechanisms for personal privacy. There has to be mechanisms for rights, for rights to your own data, rights for evaluation of data, etc. But that capacity is there. And given that we have or will have in the reasonably near future that kind of capacity, then mechanisms for testing, for badges, for certifications, these are all short-term temporary measures that we use as a stepping stone to the longer-term solution. So the new model of work and learning, to wrap up the talk, three major factors. The first factor is sharing. To learn, to do, is to share. We share documents, we share data, we share objects, we share what we do, how we work, what we believe, what we value within a distributed network with our friends and with the friends of our friends. We don't necessarily share it with the world, but we share enough and to enough people that the world can know about us. It also means contributing, not just sharing, but actually engaging in interactive activities with people, to build things, to create things, to enter into contracts, short-term, long-term, etc. And ultimately, it means co-creating, not collaboration, but cooperation, where each of us does our own bit toward some larger objective that might be in undefined. You might think of Marvin Minsky's The Society of Mind, except in society. So that overall is the model of the future of learning that we're looking at. And I thank you for your time and your attention, and if we have time, I'd be happy to take any questions. These slides and the audio of this talk will be available on my website again within a day or so. Thank you, everyone. Okay. Yes and no. I've talked about the concept to a lot of government departments. I where I work, I have access to that. In the different departments that I talk to, you know, everything from human resources to Industry Canada, I don't know the new names of all of these portfolios. So there's a lot of excitement over the idea. There are some initial projects. For example, the Treasury Board Secretariat has a project called Micro Missions that we're involved with. And the idea of a micro mission is that a government department or agency that has a short-term need for a specific skill puts that skill into a database. That skill is matched with the skills database of people who work in the government, and a person in another department can be identified to fill that micro mission. So there's the matching thing, there's the personal learning record thing. That's actually underway. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for that sort of thing. When I've talked to both military and human resources people, like SRDC, you know, the employment assurance people, again, they're very excited about the idea of being able to match people to jobs, and even more to the point, looking at the skills that people have and identifying how they, you know, what skills they need in order to obtain employment opportunities that currently exist, and being able to improve those skills. So that's the yes part. You know, at the actual working level of government, there is a lot of interest. I haven't seen as much interest at the policy and political level. There certainly is not yet any sort of policy initiative that I've seen related to a personal learning record. Even, you know, the idea of electronic health records is fraught with issues and difficulties. A personal learning record has many of these same difficulties, although the risks aren't quite as much. So, but I don't see a program specifically directed toward creating a PLR. So I think a PLR might be something that is adopted by government kind of at the grassroots level rather than the policy level overall. Thanks, everyone.